Les conférences du Collège de France.
Last lecture, it's about mean-field control and the Fleming viewer processes. And this is a continuation of the joint work with Pierre Cadalaguet and Joe, who is here today, but also we have a fourth collaborator here, Marco Sirant. Okay, I'll try to spend most of the time explaining the problem, because the proofs are too complicated to put them on a page here, and I will only wave my hands around that. Okay. So, what is the Fleming VO process? It's a super process. It's one of these very well studied super processes, whatever that means, which are probability measures, probability measure valued Markov processes that play an important role in the development of mathematical base for the theories of allele drift. So they are generalizations of the Wright-Fisher process and arise as infinite population limits of suitably rescaled variants of processes that describe finite populations. And typical examples are model variety increasing processes such as mutations or genetic drift and natural selection and things like that. Fleming and Viau developed that. I went to Brown in 83, so they already had that before. We never talk about it. I never saw why he did it, but it turns out that it's very useful. Okay, so let me give a brief description of what it is. So you have n particles that are, in the most simplified version, you have n particles that move according to independent Brownian motions, and every epsilon units of time, two particles are chosen uniformly, and the first particle jumps to the location of the second, and while between the jumps, they keep moving like Brownian motion. So there's an exchange that is done at some random time, and as the number of particles goes to infinity and the epsilon, the time at which this happens, goes to zero, the empirical distribution of the measures converge to a random measure, which for dimensions greater or equal 2, in general, has fractal nature. And the original Fleming-Viau model, you will see it in a minute with equations, assumes independence of the branch between the branching mechanism, which is the jump and the exchange they do, and the spatial distribution of the particles. Okay, all these things are. So I want to look and under the title Fleming-Viau is a very general title. There are many processes that look like. That are called Fleming-Viau processes, but all of them have this characteristic that I mentioned. So let's start again. This is a model that was introduced by Bartzi, Hollis, Ingerman, and Mars. So we have now n particles, again as before, moving according to independent Brownian motions, and there is a hard obstacle. Think of it as being the boundary of a set where the particles are killed. And the offsprings are generated, once they're killed there, each particle creates an offspring, is generated in a uniform way across the whole population. And so in the particular model we're doing, is a particle jumps to any location in the interior of the domain, but it's uniform. So it sees a uniform average of the particles in all the other locations. The assumption of the constant number of individuals, the n, is an idealization of the constant carrying capacity of the environment. And in that particular model, the asymptotic limit is a smooth measure. So we have propagation of chaos, where for large n, any two particles become almost independent. And the propagation of chaos holds for the entire descendants of the particles of these positions. And there is a minimization of entropy production, which in the model we're going to describe, it has to do with the minimizing property of the first Laplacian eigenfunction. Okay, so now let's be a little bit more precise. So we're working in a bounded domain with smooth boundary. B will always be a d-dimensional Brownian motion, P of D is a set of probability measures, And I'm describing the continuous version of the model, and tau is the first exit time of the Brownian motion from the boundary. Typically, one is interested in the conditional law, and you had a whole course in here by Pierre-Louis years ago about conditional laws. So we have the conditional law of the Brownian motion for times before the exit time, which of course can be seen as that ratio here, and that's a probability measure, so that since it's a conditional law, it's like that. And you can express it in terms of this function pi bar to become, in order to have a probability measure, where p solves this simple-looking heat equation in the domain with zero boundary conditions and starting at the initial distribution of the particles. Now, this equation does not preserve measures. If you start with probability measure, solution may not, you lose mass there. So you need to normalize it to keep it a probability measure. Okay, so that's, now the large limit, large time limit of the conditional distribution is going to be characterized by the eigenvalues of the Laplacian with the Dirichlet conditions. So here is the increasing sequence like that. And the first eigenvalue will be rho 1. And here's the result that is known. It's not that we did anything about that. Is that this p bar, which is the ratio between the normal, is the renormalized solution to the reaction to the heat equation, converges to a measure that is absolutely continuous with respect to the Lebesgue measure, and it's nothing else but the renormalized first eigenvalue, renormalized to have. Integral 1, and this convergence is related to the fact that that measure, the rho dx measure, is known as the unique quasi-stationary distribution of the Brownian motion killed upon hitting the boundary. So that's a background. So now let me tell you, talk a little bit more exact about this model. So we have a process, a dn value process. It starts at some location x. While they're in the domain, the particles move like Brownian motions. And once they hit the boundary, this is what I tried to say earlier, once the particles hit the boundary, a particle immediately jumps to the location of one of the other remaining n minus one in the interior, and it chooses the location with a uniform distribution. Okay, so here are the results that are known before I write the equations down. This system is well defined, so that's what probably is true. And as n goes to infinity, if the initial distributions have a limit, then the empirical distributions of the Fleming VO process will converge to the renormalized p bar, which is always a renormalized solution to the heat equation. And the superscript m means that we started with the initial condition m. But also for each fixed n, without sending n go to infinity, and to infinity, the particle has an invariant measure, pn, and the two limits, the large time and the large n limits, commute. So you can go t to infinity, you can go n to infinity, t to infinity, or you can go t to infinity and then n to infinity, and you get the same answer. And references for that, okay, so there's the original paper I mentioned, the Burgi-Hollist, Engelmann and Mars, Burgi-Hollist and Mars, Borgia himself, Grigorescu and Kang, Lobus, and more recently is a paper by Nolan and Taff, where they look at a more sophisticated, more complicated problem which looks like has a drift. Okay. So there's a lot of work and probability on that. I must say that when you look at the original Fleming VO paper, you don't see any of these things. It's an abstract paper where they're using semigroups and domains and so on, and there is never a discussion of that type. So what Burgi did with his collaborators put that in a more concrete way in terms of a particle system. Okay. All right, now let me come down to Earth and write some equations. So I have to write down, since we're going to do PDEs in the end, I have to write some equations. So let me start with a backwards Kolmogorov equation, which is associated with the Fleming-Vio process that I described. So for some terminal condition G, nice, we can define that quantity, which is supposed to solve, whose solution should be the solution of the backwards Kolmogorov equation for that. And so here's the equation we get for each n. In the interior of the domain, you get the heat equation. I said that many times. Once they're in the interior, they move like Brownian motions. Once they hit the boundary, so if you are in a location x with one component on the boundary, let me do that later. This is confusing, but let's think you are at the boundary. So if one particle is on the boundary, so immediately jumps, and the value there is equal to the average of the values at the other point. Now x, I, superscript I, j means at the ith location, we put the jth component. All right? So that means that the particle jumps in a location, it's not there anymore, so finds an empty spot, replaces j, and now this element here has two elements the same. Okay? And then it starts moving again, and of course, this should be capital T. I did port forward in time, so the initial condition would be the condition we put there. All right, so now let me explain the boundary. The boundary is what causes all the difficulty, most of the difficulty in this problem. So let's say we are in 3D, and the domain, what I'm drawing is not smooth, but it's a so from that boundary, which is the boundary of dn, so d now will be this cube, dn, the boundary of dn will be everything on the sides, the di, the d1i is the part of the domain where only one particle is there. So it's the faces of the cube without including the around what happens. And the domain, the boundary of the full domain, which we know what it is the union of the open faces. This is the D1. The lines, which is going to be the D2. And the whole, and then the last one, which is this point. Okay? So you can classify the boundary you can separate it in these three things. And the only thing that matters for the equation is the open surface. What happens there? Okay, so all these things here are to explain the notation. This notation will come up again. So it means that at the ith slot, we put xj. I put that in as a point that the lateral boundary condition is only put on the one boundary, on the part of the boundary where only one particle is there instead of two. All right, so let's describe, let me now, this is the time to say what is that we do. So we prove a quantitative, our work is about quantitative, uniform in time, weak propagation of chaos for the particles. So basically what we want to do is we want to quantify this limit. So as n goes to infinity, it can be shown, and people have shown that this quantity here, which is moving the vn's up to the probability measure, so I will show you in a minute another way to see that. People know that goes to the solution u of this very simple infinite dimensional transport equation. So this is nothing else but a limit as n goes to infinity of the Laplacian that we had before. The boundary condition is going to be Neumann boundary condition. You should see it from there that if you were to let n go to infinity and evaluate this thing at the empirical measure, you're going to get, if you start expanding, you're going to see that you get an average of the linear derivative of u there, and so the condition is that this has to be 0, and the initial condition is what it was before. Notice, if you remember, that this is also the same boundary conditions, so the same type of equation that we came up in these boundary conditions that we came up in the absorption paper that I described, results that I described the second lecture. Okay, so studying the n to infinity limit of the particle system, we're doing it using the convergence of the Vn's to U, and this is an adaptation of the weak propagation chaos method developed for weakly interacting diffusions, but without boundary conditions, the Fleming-Vio boundary conditions, by a number of people there. And these people did not have to deal with the boundary conditions, which are the real problems. Okay, so this is what I want to prove. And so here's the result in a simplified form. If we start with regular enough initial condition G, then we can prove that uniformly in time, at sup over all times, the rate between these two quantities, the difference of that, is like 1 over n. In the constant, there is stuff there. So rewriting it as in terms, keeping in mind that this is basically that probability, and that the UTM, I will tell you later, is equal to GPT, then you have... this estimate can be rewritten in that form. So the 1 over n rate of convergence is most probably optimal, especially because one can see easily that it's optimal when you do interacting particle systems without this resampling mechanism of the Fleming-Vio process. So if there are no boundary conditions, then it's known that the rate is 1 over n. And now you can write this in a more sophisticated way. If you decide to measure the convergence in terms of the H minus S norm, of the rate remains 1 over n. But if you want to rewrite the estimate we have in terms of the 1 Wasserstein metric, then you see you lose, and you start bringing this state in it. So if the 1 over n was optimal there, we expect it to be optimal here. But the D1, we don't expect to be an optimal, have an optimal rate. Okay. And if Pn is the invariant measure of the n particle Fleming-Vio particle system, then we also have this rate. Okay. So for the remaining of the talk, I will try to explain a little bit more everything that is in this page. Okay, first let's start with the related literature. And there are not many references about rate of convergence for Fleming Vio models. So Werner Monnet, if I maybe don't pronounce the name correctly, found error estimates for general Markov processes. And when you apply his general estimates to the Fleming-Vio system, you get a rate like that. And you get a rate like 1 over square root of n. So he gets a worse rate than the 1 over n we have. But he has to do that for any arbitrary bounded initial condition, which is equivalent to taking, in our case, our capital G to be linear. So for linear capital G, the Fleming-Vio version of the results of Wilhelm Mohr are 1 over square root of n. So that's why we think that 1 over n is the right rate. And then there is a work by Zunel and Bormanser where they look at a different model. They look at a model now where there is a drift. And here, for in the drift, the potential and the domain have to satisfy some technical conditions, which as epsilon goes to zero, they guarantee that the domain becomes a metastable for the underlying diffusion. And then for these assumptions, they are proving a result of that type. But now here they have a constant that depends on epsilon. So they need to take epsilon positive, small, and the rate they get is something like 1 over some n to some exponent eta epsilon there. So these are the two results, quantitative results we know, or at least that's the ones that Joe found in the literature. But there are some other results which have to do with soft killing. So I didn't say, I should have said perhaps earlier, what is soft killing versus hard killing. So soft killing means that the particles are resampled as they move on, but with a rate that depends on their locations, but there is not this jump that there is on the Fleming VO thing. They are not killed, so these are typically problems set in the whole domain. While, and there are results about that by a number of people, and the Fleming VO problem is a hard killing, because when the particles hit, they involve in a bounded domain, and resampling occurs when they hit the boundary. So that's the difference between soft and hard, and soft and hard killing in language here. So there are results, quantitative results, but for discrete state spaces. And there is a certain limit theorem for general class of Fleming VO particle systems. So these are basically all the references we know, but the rates are in the previous transparency. It's these two. Okay. All right, now let me start establishing some of the math that goes behind these statements I made about the rates, which I will never prove. So now let's look at that. So up here I wrote this strange-looking equation. The first time you see that equation, which is, as I said, is the backwards, the Kolmogorov equation corresponding to the particular Fleming VO model we're looking at, and when you look at this, it's, okay, it's a heat equation, what can go wrong with it? But this boundary condition is the non-local boundary condition. It's a very unusual boundary condition when you see it. So there is an issue here, why you assign this boundary condition only on the part of the boundary I mentioned and not at the full boundary. One way to describe the difference between that part of the boundary and the other parts, the sides and the corners, is that on the part of the boundary you are working, only one particle is on the boundary, the rest are inside. Now, probabilists will tell you that this is because the probability that two Brownian particles can hit the boundary at the same time is zero. Okay, so for the probabilist, the fact that the boundary condition is only there, it's obvious. They are modeling practical systems, and they cannot hit the boundary almost surely at the same time. From the PDE point of view, and I will argue about that, it's down here, is we need to show that the PDE basically cannot be satisfied on the parts of the boundary that we are throwing away. And I will discuss that in a minute. And the second main obstruction we have is that the initial condition is not compatible with the boundary condition up there. So we are not assuming that the function gn, when it's evaluated at a single point in any of these points here, satisfies that condition. So we expect to have some singularity at the corners, at t equals zero, and the parts of the boundary that don't contain the complement of these faces. So we are going to get solutions which are going to be continuous forget the time, they're going to be continuous in the domain, union all the sides, but not the edges, and continuous at time t equals zero only in the interior, because we are not assuming that the function g satisfies the boundary condition, even at the nice parts of the boundary. Okay. So how to define a solution is not a big deal. It's a smooth equation. So we have a subsolution in the interior, and we have a super solution if it satisfies everything with the opposite inequality. And then it's not difficult, since we are dealing with this definition, actually, it's not difficult to see that you're going to have comparison. Okay, the proof, however, it's easy to say, it's difficult to do, because you have to exclude the possibility that the maximum of the difference of two solutions, the subsolution and the supersolution, can occur on the boundary, on the bad parts of the boundary. These are, the functions are bounded, so the sup can be on the bad, parts of the boundary, and then we don't know the equation. So what you need to do is, to, when we look at this classical maximum principle, you write down the difference, you need to make sure that the sup over the time clause, this is the total sup here over the d bar n, that sup cannot happen on any other part of the boundary but the faces. And also it cannot happen on the part, on the at equal zero, on the boundary of the domain. So typically you do that by building, finding two functions here, two barriers that you put. The first one is one that tells you it's a smooth function again, satisfies the Flamingville boundary condition, and it has the property that as x approaches the boundary, but not in the good part of the boundary, it blows up. And the second boundary, the second auxiliary function xi, and you have to construct again, it will be a super solution, strict super solution to the Flamingville system up there, but it will blow up as t goes to zero. So you need to have a quantitative way to say that this is like that. So again, these two test functions, these two barriers are constructed in order to avoid the possibility that there is a maximum at the, what we consider to be the bad parts of the boundary where the equation is not satisfied, and also it's not satisfied at the boundary of a full domain at t equals zero. So with these two assumptions, if you plug it in and you work, you can, it follows that the maximum of this quantity here, because this is super solutions and this is what it is, it's attained in the interior, in the domain we want. Again, domain is the dn union of the faces, and at time t equals zero. And once you have that, it follows that you have the comparison. Okay, so all the work goes into the construction of these two things. And this is not something you want to see it in. Okay. So that's the comparison for the Kolmogorov equation that is associated with that. 1 minute. Okay. What about the existence of solutions? Because that's also because of the unusual boundary condition. Now that's also a bit strange about how you build this boundary condition, but that's simple. You just create a family of an increasing family of functions like that. So you start with whatever you want initially, but then you propagate with this boundary condition the solution, so you solve the heat equation with now boundary conditions that are well known because you use the previous one. And then it's not, it's immediate that this family is increasing. And also you can show that the limit is going to be the solution of the Fleming VO thing. So the Fleming VO is back there in case for the later arrivals. Okay. So what about all this big conversation about the fact that we cannot have continuity all the way up to the boundary, and you can have continuity only on this selected part of the boundary. There is one paper in probability that claims you get a continuous solution in the whole domain, but I don't think any four authors or co-authors of this paper understand what they get there. And there is a counterexample here in one dimension that if you look at this problem with boundary conditions that do look now, because you are in 1D, plus minus one, okay, the domain is not smooth here, but this is the Flamingville boundary condition in this case, because you jump, if you are, let's say, at one end, the boundary condition is N equals 2 here, so 1 over N minus 1 is 1, and you are jumping to location TYY. So this is the Fleming VO condition in 1D. And if you start with a particular initial data, which is not compatible with the boundary conditions, one can show that this problem cannot have a smooth, cannot have a continuous solution. So we don't know what the probability paper proves, but clearly you cannot expect to have continuity in all the parts of the boundary. Okay. What about the function capital U, which is supposed to be the limit? So, I remind you that PM is the solution.
The continuity is lost at near t equals 0.
At t equals 0 and on the boundary. Okay.
Because this here, is here, okay. Inside it's smooth.
The continuity you have it in the open spaces.
And so it's because of the lack of compatibility initially.
At t equals 0 is because of the lack of compatibility. But on the boundary, even if you assume it's because two Brownian motions cannot be at the same location. Okay? So at t equals 0, of course, is the lack of compatibility. Okay. So going to the this problem, so I remind you there the solution to the heat, okay, the heat equation with zero boundary conditions and initial condition and measure, where the initial condition here is the restriction, it's a subprobability measure on the domain, and then the capital U function that we want it to be evaluated in probability measures, so it is the initial condition evaluated at the normalized solution here to have integral 1, and it turns out that this is a nice function, of course. And strangely enough, or not strangely, and after a couple pages of calculations, you can compute exactly their first linear derivative and the second linear derivative. And what you see from that is they blow up near the bottom. Okay, so I don't expect anybody to see that. When I put superscript x here, it's when we start with the initial condition, the Dirac mass at x. Okay, so with this complicated formula. There is another way to formulate these conditions. It looks nicer, but it's not much more useful, so I'm going to skip this because it's another way, by duality, you can describe the boundary conditions, the normal, the linear derivatives in a nicer way in terms of some auxiliary functions here, but I'm not going to use that again in at all today, so let's might as well forget this. And let's think about estimates on the derivatives. As I said, you expect derivatives to blow up on the boundary. So here is one type of estimate you can get. If C is the difference between the smallest and the second eigenvalue, one can prove that the linear derivative of U decays in this way. Now remember, this is the integral, rho is the normalized, renormalized first eigenvalue. So you have an estimate of that type, which means that if you are near the boundary, if the M measure is concentrated near the boundary, it's a bad boundary because rho vanishes on the boundary. And a similar estimate for the increasing second derivative, where this estimate here is true only from 1 and forward. You need to do something more for that. And to bridge the gap and to have an estimate from the second derivative starting at 0, you need to do something more complicated. You need to build a particular barrier. So after all the barriers here would be some function of the distance to the boundary. And the barrier you need to construct here is done in terms of a fundamental solution of the transition kernel for this like strange looking star has D, and the gamma is the fundamental solution to that problem. And this has to do with somehow you try to measure the number of points, the number of times that you hit the boundary. Okay, so if you use that barrier, then you can close the gap there and go from time 0 to 1, But then at the expense of these barriers on the right-hand side. So again, since it's a finite interval, there's not a matter of time interval, it's not a question of decay as time goes to infinity, but you have again this blow up and this function is doubled. So these are highly technical, but also necessary estimates to have if you want to quantify the rate of convergence. Okay, then it's not difficult to show that this function u is a C12 solution of the infinite dimensional space, once again with zero linear derivative of the boundary. So now we have done the Vn. I showed you a little bit about the Vn, what you expect. I show you that the capital U solves the PDE, and also I show you that we have some sophisticated estimates for the derivatives, the blow up of the derivatives. Okay. So now we want to do the usual thing. We want to project down the solution of the infinite dimensional PDE at the n level. And so we want to see what are the properties of the function un, which is the u evaluated at the empirical measure at x, and see how many of these properties of the capital u will translate at the level n. Of course, if the un function, what I defined there, was an exact solution, then we wouldn't have to do anything. But there is an error. So the error goes like that. If you look at the function un, it has the regularity you want, because the capital function u had the right regularity, but you are making an error in the equation, which is related. If you look at that here, it's related to the estimates on the second derivative of the intrinsic second derivative of the boundary. That's why you see this function is w here. And on the boundary, there is an error that it's simpler to see. It's like n over n squared. And now you see from here that the error blows up as you go to the boundary, because the rows are zero on the boundary. So if so you see there's a difference between all the points. If you have more than one, if you are in the D2 part of the boundary or higher, but not in D1. Okay. Okay, so now let me try to give you the idea of the proof of the rate of convergence. So as I said, we take the U, we project it down, and we try to estimate this difference. So I had it earlier, the UN solves, if I write it in terms without writing the derivatives, without writing the estimates, the capital UN, this is what is the rate, that's what what is left over, and this is the one I estimated. This estimate here came from the upper bound we had for the second derivative on the boundary, and the boundary condition is expressed in terms of the second linear derivative. So to be able to prove a rate of convergence, we need to have good estimates for the right-hand side, with some of which we do. Now, what is the difficulty is that the PM, which is the solution to the corresponding underlying heat equation, becomes less regular when more of the mass of M is near the boundary. And so we cannot expect to have global estimates, because the M can concentrate near the boundary. And so we need more accurate estimates near the boundary to explain the behavior of the derivatives. Okay. So we want to re-express, re-expressing the error estimates I showed you before. The previous estimates before were in terms of the fundamental, in terms of principal eigenvalue. Here they are to quantify better their behavior. They are expressed in terms of the distance to the boundary. So the error estimate you have for the equation, it's evaluated, okay, these are these W barrier functions which were built using this diffusion equation, and the rest has to do with distance to the boundary. But notice that as t goes to infinity, these rates go to zero. So this is everywhere in the domain, while this one is an estimate you're going to have only on the good part of the boundary, the d1 there. And so these are the new and sharper estimates we have to use. So the new rates, you see there is the 1 over n there, seem to imply that you are going to get a rate of convergence will be like 1 over n. On the other hand, these estimates blow up near t equals 0 for the lack of compatibility and near the, let's call it bad part of the boundary where two particles, at least two particles may come together. Okay, so all previous work that I refer to about the weak propagation of chaos relied on what they call to be a trajectory approach. So they write down the difference between, they want to control the same error, what I said before, but instead of putting here an x and x and look at the PDE, they're putting here the moving trajectories and they try to establish an estimate of that type. But since all our error estimates we have are not uniform, trying to execute the strategy will require a very delicate analysis of the particle system, controlling in a qualitative way the amount of time it spends near the boundary and where the second intrinsic derivative and linear derivatives blow up, the number of times they hit the boundary, and so on. So it's a mess. And it turns out it's easier to do it to the PDEs I had before. So, and the estimates, we get them in two steps. One is a finite time interval, let's say one, and then for t bigger than one all the way to infinity to get a uniform. So for a finite time, okay, we put it one, doesn't matter, this is the rate we get. So for any eta positive, and the eta comes there, so you see what it is, there is a constant here that depends on eta, that the rate is in terms, I keep changing the, writing the first eigenvalue, the normalized first eigenvalue and the distance function, but anyway, that's the rate you get for finite time, and then the uniform time estimate, it looks more complicated, but this is something you can control. This is sum now up to 9 of something. I cannot explain that. It's some expansion that you need to go up to there to be able to apply the inequalities you need. But the rate, again, is like 1 over n. So both rates are 1 over n times some crazy factor. All right. So I said at the beginning I was going to give you a sketch of the proof, but now I'm going to give you a sketch of the sketch of the proof, which is based on the, at some point, a long time, I mean, I wrote that estimate just before, I just copied, it's there, and I'm going to show you the proof that ignores that error. Because if I put that there, then there's no way I can. I will say at the end what is that you need to do if you look at the actual estimate. So now I'm going to assume that somehow we are lucky and we have very explicit upper bounds in terms of the distance to the boundary. Okay? So no doubling. Okay, so what we need to do again is build a particular barrier to take care of the bad parts of the boundary, take care of T0 and also the bad parts of the boundary. So it turns out that the function here is very simple, looks like that's the principal, the first eigenvalue, some function like that. And if you write down this function, if you write down the function phi n, the function which of the empirical measure, then you see that in the interior, there is a lower bound that blows up like that. And on the boundary condition, you have another lower bound. Okay, so that's almost explicit. And what you do, you look at, you use that right, or whatever enjoying your function, to control the max of this difference, with the hope that because of the properties of the phi n, you can control, you can show that because of that, the maximum cannot happen either at t equals 0 and the boundary, or on the bad parts of the boundary, the more complicated parts of the boundary. And you can do that if you choose epsilon to look like c over n, where c is large and n of c will be large and n will be large. So let me very briefly tell you what happens. So we look at that max, the soup, and we want to exclude the possibility that it will happen at on the boundary. So for the boundary, if it happens, if the soup is on the boundary, then, and again, I have to be careful the way I write it here, because this is now soup on the good part of the boundary. So if you are there, the maximum point, I have one coordinate on the boundary, then you get this lower bound in the equation, using the error estimates, and then because of this bound, you see that you get a contradiction if epsilon is greater or equal c over n for some c. So you cannot have maximum on the good part of the boundary. And then you check what happens if it happens, if the maximum occurs at the interior. And there, there's some number, some equations you have to put here. But it turns out that, so before we needed to choose epsilon bigger than c over n for some c, and the second part says, now if you take that some c to be large, the maximum cannot happen even in the interior, so it happens at t equals 0, and we are and we have the rate we want. Okay, so what happens if you use the correct estimate for the error in the equation in the interior? So instead of building one barrier phi n, you have to build three. The one of them will be like the phi n I had before, but we had to be more singular, and the two and three are there, to compensate for the error you make when you go near the boundary. And to get the uniform rate of convergence, you take advantage of the fact that as time goes, the rates we had were like e to the minus ct, so they were decreasing in time, so in some sense, when t was going to zero, when t going to infinity, you have no error, and that's how you can put it together. Okay, so I said from the beginning, there is no way I can show you any real math about that besides moving my hands. So that's the end of it for this particular linear model with all in the Laplacian. I mentioned there are more sophisticated models. We look like looking glass equations with a drift that depends also on the density. And we don't know yet whether we can impose, whether we can use drift in these models. Most probably we can if we use, and the key thing, somehow that has to be played an important role. So if there is a drift, maybe one can make the C0 larger and take care of the drift. And we have started looking now at nonlinear versions of that model, keeping in mind that we'd like to get some large deviation result for the type result for the Fleming-Vio model, which will involve now solving equations with quadratic nonlinearities and so on. And that's something that we have started doing it, and we're far away from the answer. Anyway, so that's the last lecture. So thank you very much, those of you who came to listen. And that's it. I'm done.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.